So you ready to do this? All right, let's roll with the news.
It's time for the most insightful wrestling show today. Wrestling Weekly is on the air.
Are we ready?
I'm very excited.
Please join us in the chat room at WrestlingWeekly.com to submit questions for tonight's guests.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, and you are listening to Doc Young.
He is my friend.
And the inimitable Les Thatcher.
He's a legend. He's one of the greatest of all time.
You're listening to Wrestling Weekly.
The most dominant force in this business today.
And it all starts tonight.
Yeah.
We're the stars of this piece of...
And now, your host for Wrestling Weekly, Doc Young and legendary Les Thatcher.
Doc Young and Les Thatcher with you here at Wrestling Weekly. And you're going to have to forgive us today if the show's not all that entertaining. I think that's a good way to start it out.
Yeah, I think that's a good way, Doc. Let me say right up front, if I happen to say I excuse me for a moment and step away, you'll please understand that not only did the wrestling profession lose a gifted, talented, tremendous performer today, but I lost a hell of a friend. And I've just learned about this, for those who are listening, less than 2 hours ago. I am in Maggie Valley, North Carolina. I've been out of the internet loop since Friday, and no one had contacted me with this until just a couple hours ago, and so I'm pretty devastated too, Doc. There's a huge void in professional wrestling tonight. Those fans who appreciate true professional wrestling the way it should be have lost a great talent, and those of us who called Eddie Guerrero a friend have lost a loved one. I mean, he was talented, he was passionate, intense, gifted, a caring friend, and I was looking forward to SmackDown comes to Cincinnati, where I live, on the 29th of this month, and I just was telling my wife on the trip down here Friday, I was looking forward to seeing Eddie and Chris Benoit and you know some of the guys that I was close to.
Right.
And you know, as I said to you before, just a few moments ago before we came, I don't know if there's a how you can even come up with a positive out of this, but except for the fact that he was at the top of his game, he was with his family, things were going right for him and had been for several years, and having been on the other end of that with him a little bit, I know tonight that two other of my friends and certainly two of his very close friends, Dean Malenko and Chris Benoit, must be totally devastated as well. I haven't had a chance to talk to anybody, but as I said to you too, I don't know what the correct word to use, irony, the ironic thing is this is a sort of a deja vu in a way to me, because in 1997, it was not September, I think, or October of 97 when Brian Pillman passed. It was on a Sunday, and we were sitting down to watch the pay-per-view in my home with myself and some of my students when I got a phone call that Brian had passed away. If I'm babbling, please forgive me. I am trying to make sense of this for myself, as well as trying to say what I really feel emotionally about this man. He spent time with me at my school a few years ago when he was going through some fighting some of his demons and finally beat them. And I was telling my wife earlier. I said to watch him with the kids that we train. And see the fire flashing in his eyes when he talked about the business. I mean, I guess the positive is that he went out on top of his game and that he was doing what he loved, and that things were right with he and his wife and the kids. And, I guess some of the best stuff he's done in terms, not necessarily wrestling, but, his acting skills.
Yeah.
Over the last several months, the deal with he and Ray Ray, although it may not have been an angle that everybody thought was the greatest idea in the world, I mean, what can you say? He took whatever he had, was offered, laid out for him, and made the best of it, and did you know, did an excellent job with whatever was in front of him.
Yeah, we were just talking last week about his acting skills.
Yes, and the weekly column I do for PW Insider, I had just posted on Thursday, 2 weeks ago, I had mentioned that he and Charvel Huffman, if I were doing a movie and casting out of the wrestling world, would be my leading man and leading lady,
mm-hmm.
because I thought they, you know, both that did so well, you know, with emotions and microphone, you know, and their work and skills on the microphone. Oh man, I can only say that, you know, again, it's such a void. I mean, you know, after everything he'd gone through, you know, with the car wreck a number of years ago, which would have killed an average person. He lived through. He came back. Then he went through, you know, went through the rehab thing, and just, you know, he was just. I remember going down to the Cincinnati First Star Center when he was the champion, and having heard that that he had, you know, was feeling a little bit of the pressure, and I know we got a chance to talk, and I said, you know, you're so, but the thing of the pressure was, it wasn't that he couldn't deal with it, it was that he took the whole load on his own shoulders. He thought, well, they've put the belt on me, finally, and now if anything bad happens, I'm at fault, and of course that's not true either. You know, although it's a business of individuals in many ways, it's still a team sport in so many others. And I know I said to him then, I said, you know, don't let this pressure get to you. And he just gave me a big smile and threw his arm. He said, yeah, thanks, baby. He said, you know, thanks, brother, I love you. And I said, yeah, me too. But he came, and there's a, you know, and I don't know, again, if this is the right time or the right place to say it, but I was sitting here thinking, too, when he and his wife were separated and he was having some problems, Brian Adams came into my office one morning and said, can I ask you something? I said, sure. And he said, Eddie called me last night, and he said he just felt that with, you know, he and his wife had separated, and he was having his, you know, his problems at the time. He said he thought if he could come up here with us, he would just, you know, he'd be keep busy. And he said, to work out of here and also help you with the kids. I said, man, you know, the door is open.
Right.
And he came to Cincinnati and stayed with us and worked with the kids and trained. And God, I just can't tell you what he has meant to the wrestling business. And, you know, I had just done an interview just last week for the Christian Wrestling Entertainment newsletter, and they had said, if you could see any two wrestlers today wrestle against one another, who would you want? It didn't even take me 30 seconds to write down Benoit and Guerrero,
mm-hmm.
you know? And the business has lost something. I mean, it really has. And as personally, I'm devastated. One of our guests tonight, who's going to be with us, J.J. Dillon, is that kind of friend for me too. And you know, I'm sure he'll understand. I mean, you know, it's just, but to see a guy who has fought off so many adversity, so much adversity, be struck down at so young in life is just terribly sad for me.
Yeah, absolutely. We were supposed to have Diamond Dallas Page on tonight, and Diamond has postponed the interview due to Eddie's passing. So, you know, I can understand that. We can all understand that, and he'll be back with us next week. JJ is going to be joining us in the second hour. He's going to be talking about his memories of Eddie, and we've also got Bruce Buchanan from PW Torch going to be joining us in just a little bit for the Hot Topic. He's also going to be...
Bruce who?
I'm sorry. Bruce Mitchell.
I know.
Bruce Mitchell from The Torch is going to be talking with us about Eddie, of course, also. So it's going to be an all
Who's
Eddie
Bruce
night.
Bruce Buchanan?
I don't know.
I don't know either. Oh, God. It's... Sean Stenham, who does the Wrestling Guys, which is a regional radio show based in a city called Middletown, which is, surprisingly enough, midway between Cincinnati and Dayton, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
He does the Wrestling Guys show, and he's actually the one who called me and informed me about this because he knew of my and Eddie's relationship. And he was reminiscing that when Eddie got cut. That was the other thing, too. Instead of coming one evening, instead of coming back to Cincinnati, he had gone on to Tampa, and I guess he and the wife at the time, because they were trying to sort things out, and he became emotionally distraught and had a few drinks just before he'd gone to rehab. And this is, again, I'm not telling stories out of school here. This was totally public knowledge, and it, you know, bounced his car off the gate in the gated community where they live, and at this point had been released. And he came back to the, you know, he came back up to the gym, and Sean's show is on Wednesday nights, and he had already planned to have Eddie on that coming Wednesday night, and he came down to my gym and came in and saw Eddie, and he came up and he said, look, he said, probably in lieu of what's happened, he said, you probably won't want to do the show. And Eddie said, listen, he said, I promise you I'd do the show. And Sean said, yeah. He said, well, then I'm going to do the show.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I made you a promise and I'm going to keep it. And that's the kind of man Eddie Guerrero was. And, you know, it's just, and I guess we'll hear a lot of, you know, I'm just, again, I'm not sure, you know, how this is going to play out for the guys, because like I say, I know for all his toughness, Chris Benoit is a very sensitive and very emotional person, and I know this has got to be tearing him up as well as Malenko and you know the guys who are close to Eddie, and the company has taken a huge loss, and as I said, those of us who were his friends have obviously, you know, there's a huge. I feel very empty right now. It's nice. Dallas has the option of checking out, and I wish I did too. But
right.
But Eddie, you know what Eddie'd say?
What would Eddie say?
Eddie'd say, "You got something to do? Do it."
Yeah.
He loved his business. He loved the wrestling business, and you know that's JJ. We'll talk to him about that. I finished his book, and I've also just finished reading Pride and Passion, Pain and Passion. I'm sorry. The story of Stampede Wrestling, and got a lot of the emotions that I felt about the business, and you know, the people in it have come out in both those books, and I think, you know, maybe some of the people listening are saying, well, you know, with all the problems that Eddie Guerrero had, how can you say that, you know, but I think that's what all of us who actually have a passion for this industry and do love it and make it a part of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Go through that emotional roller coaster ride. I don't care, you know, how much money you're making or how little. It's something that happens. But he's always, you know, he's hung in there, and all I can say is I'm happy that he find, you know, that the deal with him and Chris getting the belts and the whole thing of them bonding over that at the big pay-per-view, I just, at least that happened.
Right.
You know,
WrestleMania 20 was...
Yes, that's absolutely no consolation to his wife or his children or his brothers or his family at all, but,
right.
You know, at least that is a extremely positive memory that they will have.
Absolutely. We are going to go ahead and play the WWE press conference from earlier today. This took place about 12:30. I don't know if anybody else has played this yet, but you'll probably be hearing a lot of it. But unless you went to WWE.com, this is probably the first place you'll hear it. So this is the press conference with Vince McMahon, Chavo Guerrero, who was Eddie's nephew, and good friend, not just family, you know?
Exactly.
And we're going to play that for you now. And when we come back, we're going to have Bruce Mitchell from The Torch join us here on WrestlingWeekly.com.
I'm Vince McMahon, chairman of World Wrestling Entertainment. This is Chavo Guerrero, who obviously was the closest, professionally and perhaps personally, to Eddie Guerrero, as you can be. They traveled together from Phoenix here last night, and Chavo was with Eddie last night. And we'll take whatever questions you have.
Do you know how he died?
That's still pending right now. There's they're doing an examination tomorrow morning, I believe. But we don't know actually anything really.
Were you in the room with him? What happened?
No, I wasn't in the room. I got a call from security in the morning saying that he missed his wake-up call. So the security guard had remembered us from, you know, years past, so he called me. I went up to his room, and we found him out. So I didn't think anything of it. I thought, is he all right? What's going on? I pulled him out, and I turned him over. I said, okay, something's not right. I called 911, started CPR, and that's it. That's what they pronounced him.
Was there anything unusual last night?
No. I'm sorry.
Was there anything unusual last night?
No, ma'am. We flew in together, watched the movie on the plane. We checked in. We went to get a bite to eat. That's what's so strange about it. I talked to him 30 minutes after he checked in. He was fine.
What time did you get the call from security this morning?
I checked in. We both checked in at roughly 12:30 or so. I got a call in the morning. A.M. I'm sorry. Yeah, 12:30 a.m. And got a call in the morning, 7 o'clock a.m.
Is Rick
Dan
maybe considered this? How big a loss is this for WWE?
Well, this is a huge loss for WWE. Eddie Guerrero was one of the stellar performers. I dare say one of the more stellar performers in the history of our business. His family has a deep-rooted history in professional wrestling. As a matter of fact, Chavo probably is the last of the bat, so to speak, at the moment. The Guerrero family had a rich tradition in this business. And Eddie was a performer that few could excel to be. Eddie was a giving, wonderful, loving, fun-loving human being who had so much to give in terms of his performances, and his motto of lie, cheat, and steal was paramount. And Eddie was a consummate performer, and he will be so missed by WWE fans. There is only one Eddie Guerrero.
Are you going to do anything tonight to pay tribute to him?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we're going to have a tribute show for Eddie tonight, both Raw and SmackDown, actually. Eddie had so many friends, and as well as so many fans. We had so many friends in the locker room, and so many of our performers want to say a farewell to Eddie. And they want to say a tribute to what Eddie meant to them and their lives. So tonight, which will air on Monday night, and a subsequent Friday for SmackDown, that's pretty much what you're going to see. You're going to see these human beings, really, not so much as performers, but as friends of Eddie Guerrero, who want to say something about and to Eddie. So you'll see tributes. We'll see as well some of the great matches that Eddie Guerrero participated in, and as well as obviously action in the ring. But all of which, and I might add that today, all of the performances by our individuals are voluntary. There's nothing that says you have to compete. You can imagine what effect this has had on our locker room. It's been devastating, but nonetheless, everyone in that locker room, to a man, feels as though Eddie Guerrero, being the consummate performer that he is, would want the show to go on. So they want to be a part of this tribute. They want the show to go on, and they want to be a part of the show.
It sounds like the show is changing drastically.
It's changing drastically, and it's changing as we speak. Yes. This is not in any way, obviously, what had been planned.
Are you going to participate tonight?
Yes. Yes, I am. They gave me the option if I could fly home if I wanted to, or stay in my hotel room, do whatever. But if this is a tribute show to Eddie, then I definitely want to be a part of it, and I know that he'd want me to be a part of it also.
Mr. McMahon talked about the loss to the WWE community.
Talk
about the loss to
it's uncomparable. We've never had a tragedy like this. When my grandfather passed away, Eddie's father, he was older in age, so it was expected. But we've never had a tragedy like this as far as somebody that was taken so young. And it's going to devastate the family, and it has devastated the family already. And we just got to try to pull together.
Did he teach you to wrestle?
He had a very big part in it. They all did. We've all taught all the Guerreros. There was Gory, my grandfather, his father, and then Chavo Sr., Mondo, Hector, and Eddie, we all kind of had a hand in helping each other out.
How old was Eddie?
Eddie, 38.
And he has two daughters, is that correct?
Three daughters.
How old are they?
He is Shaw, I believe she's 12-ish. Sherilyn is roughly 10, 9, 10. And he has a new daughter that's Kaylee, that's 2, 3.
Does your family want you to come home, or they want you to be here?
They want me to be here. They want me to stay and help out any way I can here.
Is his family here?
No, his family's not here
he's
yet.
He's from El Paso, Texas.
He's originally from El Paso, Texas, yes.
Ironically, Eddie moved his family out to Phoenix just a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Have you talked to his wife?
Yes.
How is she doing?
She's not handling it very well, but we didn't do it over the phone. We had his sister and his mother live in Phoenix also, so we contacted his sister, who contacted the mother face-to-face, and then went face-to-face to with his wife.
Tell me, the last 5 minutes you spent with Eddie, what happened? He said he felt fine.
He felt fine. We both got wake-up calls. We were going to meet down at 8 o'clock in the morning for breakfast and then go to the gym. He said he was going to order some room service was closed, so he was going to order a takeout to come to his room, and really that was it. We hugged and kissed goodbye. We were on the plane. It was I connected from California, from Santa Ana Airport through Phoenix, and just we were on the plane. I saw him get on the plane, and I was like, oh, just out of the blue. Hey, what are you doing? So we sat next to each other. We watched the movie. We talked. Everything was fine.
Eddie's been pretty open about substance abuse,
yes,
and being clean and sober. Do you think that had any role or any effect?
Eddie just let me know on the plane that he just had his 4-year sobriety 3 days ago. I believe it was the 15th of November. So he just let me know he was very proud of it. You know, I high-fived him and hugged him and kissed him, and you know, I told him I was proud of him and that. And so,
just
that
was 3 years?
Four-year. I seriously would doubt that very, very much.
What were Eddie's addictions?
He was an addict. He was addicted to everything. But really, alcohol and a prescription, like a painkiller or something.
Have you ever heard of a case where even if you haven't been using for 4 years, your body shuts down after the fact? Have you ever heard of a case?
I don't know. I'm not a doctor.
It's speculation. You know, obviously, with Eddie's past history, you know, with the abuse that he put himself through before he got cleaned up, I think that no doubt takes a toll on your body. Whether or not that had anything at all to do with his untimely demise, I have no idea, and I guess maybe an autopsy will tell us.
How long has he been a professional?
17 years, maybe. Yeah. He started at, his debut match was when he was 18, so really 20 years.
So would you say him cleaning up his act, so to speak, was inspiration to other performers to stay clean and to keep the...
100%. Not just other performers, but other fans. He was very open about it, and was constantly getting people coming up to him, especially when I was with him in the airports, where people would tell him that they've gone through it or they're going through it, and what an inspiration that he was.
He was also very open about his newfound faith as well. The born-again Christian.
Yes.
Since 2000, Eddie was performed all over the world, including WCW, and he came into the WWE around the year 2000. Yes, Eddie Guerrero will have royalties coming in for forever. And those royalties will go straight to his family. No, just that, well, obviously we're all deeply saddened by Eddie's passing. It's going to be tough to get over, but Eddie would want the show to go on, and that's what we're going to try to do here tonight.
Do you think fans will know by the time they're here?
Yes, there's no question. We will, you know, if they don't, which I'm sure they will, they certainly will once they arrive and see what we're going to do in terms of a tribute to it. Eddie was going to be in one show. Out of SmackDown. It was be a collage type of deal.
Who's at the Marriott?
Sorry?
This is at the Marriott?
Yes, at the Marriott.
Is there anything else, Chavo, that you'd like to add about your uncle?
Like Mr. McMahon said, I know that Eddie wouldn't want the show to go on. He was 100% business, and there's other people that feed their families from this show, and I know that he would definitely want it not to halt, to keep going on and continue and, you know, feed families. And that's, you know, he had a huge heart, one of the biggest hearts of any person that I know personally. And I know that he had a lot of love for these people, and he just would, and a lot of love for the fans. And I know that he's going to be missed, not just by the family, not by the wrestlers, but by the fans, tremendously.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
We know, you hate this part, but Wrestling Weekly will return after this short break.
Why are you doing this to me?
Doc Young and Les Thatcher back here with you at Wrestling Weekly. We've got on the line right now for Hot Topic from the PW Torch, it's Bruce Mitchell. Bruce, thanks for joining us on Wrestling Weekly this week.
Yeah, it's a sad day, but an important day, too.
Really is.
Well, you know, Bruce, instead of calling this hot, this is probably more of the sad topic tonight opposed to being a hot topic, wouldn't you think?
Right.
Absolutely.
You know, if you don't mind, just before we came back on the air, you mentioned, for those who don't know, Bruce is a school teacher in Greensboro, North Carolina. You mentioned how this would affect your students. Would you start at that point and just tell the listeners that?
Well, I teach in a school that we, with 400 students, represent 38 different countries, and of course, and one of the bigger populations we serve is the Hispanic community, but also just the kids. Period. We're fans of Eddie Guerrero, the ones that was Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio, and to a lesser extent John Cena, but particularly when Eddie Guerrero a year or two ago, you know, held that title and was, you know, the babyface star of SmackDown. They really enjoyed him, and they do to this day. It's just, you know, he was one of the top talents of this generation, and that he had, not only did he have the in-ring talent, but he had that way of communicating. He had that way with his body language, his facial expressions and all that, and just, he was very entertaining, and kids could really get into lie, cheat, and steal. And they got the humor in that. That was one of the funnier things, was kids didn't, you know, they didn't take that as gospel. They took it as, this is, you know, this guy is funny, and it's like a Tasmanian devil type to watch. I mean, they liked him. So, I mean, this is, you know, when I go into school tomorrow, I'm curious to see, who knows, and whether the word's gotten out, and I bet it will. I mean, he really was, in a way, a cultural icon, too. I mean, Eddie Guerrero is an important figure for a lot of reasons.
Yes, yeah, I would agree 100%, you know, that, and, what you're saying, I said that, told Doc, I write a weekly column for Insider, and 2 weeks ago I had mentioned that if I were casting a movie out of the wrestling, just professional wrestling in general, not necessarily any particular company, after Charmel Huffman's great performance when they did the turn on Benoit 2 weeks ago, I said my male and female lead would be Eddie and Charmel.
I can really see that. I mean, you know, wrestling acting to me is a different type of acting than just what you're, it's not better or worse, it's just different, and your guests just have to be broader and all that. But the guy who could take all the normal work, psychological work, and really add all the subtleties, Terry Funk could do it, but Eddie Guerrero definitely was right up there with him. I mean, that was, that was a real strength. And yeah, Charmel has that too. But yeah, Eddie Guerrero, he could play it. But I mean, if he was one of those guys, he could play both ways and make you love him or hate him.
Yeah. We're listening to Bruce Mitchell here on Wrestling Weekly. I want to take a minute and let the listeners know that we do know that there's a problem with our chat room. Lots of people are trying to get in right now that can't get in. We're working on that. But the company that powers our chat room is basically not ours. So if you're trying to get in the chat room, just go ahead and keep trying, and hopefully be in there in time to have questions for J.J. Dillon a little bit later in the show.
That damn Bruce Mitchell is popular, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
He's overflowing our chat room.
Yeah.
It must be they know you're president of the Johnny of the Fair Play.
I have a feeling that some people want to talk about Eddie Guerrero.
Yeah. There's a lot of conflicting reports about where Eddie was found or anything. Do you know anything about that?
I know from, it happened in Minneapolis, and I talked to Wade Keller, who's the editor of the Pro Wrestling Torch and PWTorch.com, and he's talked to a lot of people, and I think it was that he'd come back, he was actually brushing his teeth when whatever happened,
mm-hmm.
and that Chavo, that the police came and found, that someone called the police because he didn't make his 7 o'clock, or whatever time it was, his wake-up call, I won't say 7 o'clock, but whatever time it was, his wake-up call, and they mm-hmm. came and checked on him, and that the police couldn't revive him, and that was it. They did have a time that Chris Benoit and Chavo Guerrero and Rey Mysterio and Dean Malenko, who you would think that they kind of had a time to say goodbye,
mm-hmm.
and there was a press conference that Vince McMahon and Chavo Guerrero had, and tonight is a Raw SmackDown in Minneapolis double television taping, because, and this is really sad too, they're going to Europe.
Right.
Yeah.
They're going to tour Europe, and Eddie's Catholic, so that means that they're probably not going to hold off on the funeral, and you have to wonder, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to have a real hard choice to make.
Yeah. I had said this, well, you mentioned Benoit and Malenko, and I had said when we opened the show, I said knowing both of them, and as tough as Chris is, he's a very sensitive, caring person, and I'm sure they're both just totally devastated,
Oh, I mean, those careers just really were together.
Yeah.
In so many different ways, and, you know, from leaving WCW to, coming to WCW, leaving WCW to go to, and they just really paralleled. They were a revolution in the business and fought the odds to really make it to where they made it, because size and supposedly being such an important thing, but talent, in their cases, talent was more important, and more than talent, work ethic. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he brought so much. You mentioned it earlier too. The guys from our generation talk so much about the business, the lost art of psychology, like the clinics that we do with EPWT, we do focus so much on that, along with facialism, body language, and Eddie was just a master. Maybe he and Benoit, and I guess Michaels as well, are like the crossovers or the throwbacks to our generation, really, that are still there.
That did everything the modern way, and also, just really did, they had all of it. Eddie had all of it.
Yes.
And just that incredible athleticism and the things that he could do in the ring, but also just the sense of timing and the sense of the acting, and even the acting in the skits. I mean, he could be really funny,
mm-hmm.
and really amusing, and then he could also be just completely serious in a way that grabbed you. As I had real problems with some of the Ray and some of the Ray Mysterio Eddie feud. Some of it just didn't make sense, and some of it I thought was too much, but I mean, his acting in that feud was phenomenal. I mean, that probably is going to, I would think, would be the feud of this year. And it has to be said too. I mean, I don't know what the decision was going to be made, but either he or Randy Orton was going to take Batista's title tonight. That was in the plan too. And
right.
I think probably the stronger argument was for Eddie.
Yeah, I would think.
So, just based on the story, not just the wrestlers, who's ahead or who's behind as far as like who's the better wrestler, but just, for storyline purposes and all that, with Eddie and Batista and all that.
Yeah.
And all that. So,
right, because Orton was still in the middle of a program.
Right. So, I mean, it kind of fed in, it would have fed into, when Batista came back, his buddy having his title. So, but, I mean, I don't know. I mean, guessing where they were going, guessing what creative wants to do, a lot of times it's fun to try, but it's not that easy to
it's
do.
It's an effort in futility.
Right. But, I mean, you just look at all the places, and either Black Tiger in Japan. And you know, you talked about his facial expressions. I mean, you know, when he turned in Mexico and joined up with Art Barr, the late Art Barr in Los Gringos Locos, I mean, he basically did it with his face.
Right.
And with a couple of – he really didn't even turn. He just sneered. You know, he didn't beat up anybody. He just sneered a certain way, and his body language changed. And from that moment forward, the crowd hated him. I mean, and that's a worker.
Yes.
Talent.
That's
absolutely
talent. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, the one thing I'd said to Doc earlier, too, Bruce, was he spent quite a bit – when he was – he and the wife were separated briefly, and he was going fighting his demons. He came up and spent some time with us. He had called Brian Adams and told Brian to ask me. He said, see if Les minds if I come up and stay, because I think I just if I keep myself occupied, you know, I'll just be better off. And he was so good. I mean, there's the other thing too. The guy with so much talent, had done so much, has such a resume, but he would come out in the gym with the kids and just give them everything he had. And he was patient with them. I mean, you'd see the fire come out of his eye when they weren't paying attention or something wouldn't go right. But, I mean, he was right there. And there were times, you know, we trained our contract people during the from noon to around 3, 3:30. And then the trainees that actually paid us to be at the school came in the evenings. And there were times he would wander back in the evenings and say, well, you know, can I want some help? Sure, come on, you know. And I could basically go watch television or something because
that'd be great if I can believe it. Yeah.
Yeah, because yeah. He was just, you know, it was. This is his life. I mean, there's no two, you know. And I it's what I said to Doc. I said, I don't know how stupid it sounds, or you know, at this point, after I'm not really, you know, haven't collected myself after hearing this just a couple hours ago. And but you know, if he, you know, he ended up going out doing what he loved and having, you know, walked in those same shoes. I can appreciate that. I think that's the way he would have wanted it.
I think one of the defining moments, I think, that just symbolizes Eddie and what Eddie was about was back in 1994 when Eddie Guerrero was in ECW. I had watched ECW. This was a taping before they had national TV. It was a sports channel, I believe. They were airing on in Philadelphia. And it was Eddie Guerrero versus Two Cold Scorpio in the middle of the ECW arena. And these guys did a mat wrestling classic for 30 minutes, went to a 30-minute draw, and those people in the ECW arena stood up and gave them a standing ovation. They didn't need any tables. They didn't need any weapons.
They did the same thing with Dean Malenko there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The people we're talking about, and it's kind of that those guys. We mentioned Benoit in that same grouping. Those three guys gravitated to one another, but they were basically facially different, physically different, but so totally the same in terms of what they brought to the table.
Mm-hmm. You know something. I mean, you know less more than you know, speak to this, but I mean, you know, Eddie Guerrero was a guy that was. I mean, he wore emotions on his sleeve, but it's no exaggeration. Sometimes you hear this, particularly like guys in the wrestling business, and it's kind of people blowing smoke. But one of the most popular, most liked people in the business.
Yes.
Whatever he was going through, that people just appreciated and liked him, and that they really felt close to him. And you know, part of it was he wasn't as much of a superstar as he really was. He wasn't a larger than life guy. He was. You know, somebody that you could relate to and somebody that, you know, a lot of people could relate to and a lot of people, you know, and worked so hard at it. And you saw the struggles in his face.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, it kind of runs. I mean, Chavo Jr. is just a great kid, too. And Hector it has a lot of Eddie's personality. I don't know if you've ever spent much time around Hector, but, you know, the same time. Their dad... my first contact, in fact, only contact with him was in 1966 when I wrestled in Phoenix. And I remember when Eddie and I first met, it was one of the first things that I brought up because I was so impressed. But at one point, I was the only Caucasian working that territory just before I had left. And there were times that everyone was speaking Spanish, which I can say hello and goodbye and cuss a couple words, and that's pretty much it for me. And, you know, Gory... took it upon himself would come to me and say, Les, you know, I'm sorry for this. What we're talking about is this. And he would sit there and break it down for me, you know, and which was something, I mean, you know, I was just a kid just getting my start, too. I hadn't been in the business for five or six years at the time. And but I was just so impressed by that because of who he was, you know. And, yeah, it's but the talent thing is so – I know some of the things that we use at our school – even well after Eddie had showed us, there were a series of roles, which we, for lack of anything else to call them, called them the Guerrero roles. And to explain them would be very tough, you know, on the air. But anyway, these were things that taught you balance and leverage and coordination. And all of the Guerrero kids, Eddie's dad, made them all learn these and perfect them before you even allow them in the ring. And
you know, so, I watched today, just kind of add to that, I mean, I watched today the Eddie documentary that, you know, that's on DVD that WWE showed on UPN. And
right.
They actually, I think they show, like, they have some footage of the ring in the backyard of Gory Guerrero, and they show Gory doing the, doing some deep arm drag kind of things, and then Eddie, I think Eddie and Chavo both are doing it too. Definitely Eddie, you know, doing some of that too, and it might have gone into what you're talking about.
Yeah, you know, I said to Doc, I never got a chance to see that, and then a friend of mine who contacted me actually about this tonight, said that he's going to have me a DVD up. I came and talked DVD burned and have it for me when I get home. Because, and sadly enough, Eddie's book comes out next month, right?
You know, I'd forgotten.
Yeah.
Oh gosh,
yeah.
There's a lot of those things coming out. Yeah, that's yeah. I'll have to change that. But I mean, it's real bittersweet to watch. But it's quite a story too. And I mean, he battled back against a lot of things. And you know, it's also, you know, it has to be said what happened today. And what happened today is something, you know, cumulatively that you know, had to factor in. So.
Yeah,
it's a sad, you know, that's a sad part of it too. That, you know, there was a time when as good as he was and as talented as he was, there didn't seem to be a place for him in the United States and the companies. And
yeah, well, you know, and I also told Doc that when I heard it's Sunday, and when I heard it was almost like a deja vu thing because in '97. It was in the fall that Pillman passed away in Minneapolis, right?
You know, Les, there's more parallels than that.
Beg pardon?
I mean, you know, it happened in Minneapolis.
Yeah,
all right.
In a hotel, kind of a real similar thing. There was also when Chris Benoit and Dean Malenko went to confront Eddie and went to confront manager about Eddie was in real bad shape. Was in Minneapolis too. It was in kind of the same. So I mean, there's some, you know, and again, a Sunday right before pay-per-view.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, right before. I mean, it's a TNA pay-per-view, but right before a big TV taping, right before, you know, very, very similar circumstances. And,
yeah.
You know, a lot of people have not forgotten Brian Pillman.
No.
Yeah, you were mentioning the funeral, and I was wondering too, since, I'm wondering, will they do an autopsy, which will hold the funeral up for a period of time?
Yeah, they could. I know the medical examiners were outside. I don't know whether that means autopsy or what that means, but I would assume there's going to be an autopsy. I don't think that's anything that can be. You know, but I mean, I don't know. This, it fits, you know, there's a sad pattern.
Yes.
You know, it really is.
Do you know if there's any truth to the rumor that he had breakfast with Chavo that morning? This morning, I mean.
I think they came in and ate late night, and then he went to sleep or something. But yeah, there was some confusion about that.
Like, okay.
If they'd gone to eat breakfast or not, and I don't know that that quite been settled. But I think the last I'd heard was they came in, ate something late night, and then
went to their rooms.
Then went to their rooms.
Okay.
And so that was their, what everyone seems to think is it was some kind of heart condition.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't, you know, with these situations, it's real tough and it's real early.
And it could be that, you know, we might not ever find out.
Well, yeah. You know, it's not natural for a 38-year-old to have this happen to him.
No.
I'll say that.
No. And then after that horrendous wreck that he was in.
Right.
And survived, on top of everything else we've talked about, yeah. Just to think that he just fell over, I mean, which, you know, it just...
Well, you know, sometimes it can be, you know, it can be, and it's happened before, the cumulative effects of years of keeping your muscularity up, years of pain pills, years of, you know, recreation, years of, you know, all kinds of things.
And sure.
So, you know.
Well, we just had the young basketball player who's from up around my part of the country that was with the Hawks just passed away,
right,
too, less than 30 years of age.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, that's, you know, it's you know, and I don't know, this was a real tough one. I mean, I know, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just think that this is a guy that people watched his whole career and knew what kind of talent he has and knew, you know, and just enjoyed him in so many different ways. That you could, you know, you could be a wrestling aficionado and enjoy him. You could be a person that just sat, watched it on TV and thought, God, he's hilarious, and enjoyed him, and, you know, and all those things. So, you know, we'll see. You know, I do know that they're doing Raw, both Raw and SmackDown. All 4 hours will be tributes to Eddie Guerrero.
Good.
Right. And they're going to have some of the wrestlers do some interviews, give their memories about Chavo. Or Eddie, excuse me, like they did when Owen passed away.
Yeah, I would imagine it'd be shows like that. And then I know TNA, you know, TNA has their pay-per-view tonight, and I know that they've already sent out, you know, condolences, and I know they'll do a tribute too. So.
Right.
You know, I know nothing at all about Dixie Carter, except in the situation with Candido, and in this particular situation, she seems like a very classy lady.
Yeah, I don't think they have any problems with anything like that. I mean,
yeah.
I think, you know, and they even said in their press release, you know, that a lot of their wrestlers, you know, worked with and respected Eddie. So,
right.
You know, that they'll hold up for.
What's really sad about it, he just had his 38th birthday just a few weeks ago also.
Yeah, I mean.
So on that pay-per-view night.
You know, I think, you know, he was a guy that felt everything and felt all the pressure and wanted to always, you know, give his best and carried a lot of weight for that. But I mean, I think, it's just, I mean, he had his family back. He was, you know, he was doing good work and respected and all that. And, you know, it's a shock.
Yeah, it really. And I think, you know, it's not that they. I think the company really know. Or the fans will feel that void, not so much that they're going to, you know, write anything about it into a particular storyline, but I think over the next couple months they'll see that void that we're talking about too.
There's a, I mean, there's a void of talent in you know, in WWE right now. I mean, there's a void of talent in the wrestling business right now of top stars that can perform at a certain level. So I mean, yeah, I mean, I mean I can't imagine anyone not thinking this is true, the most entertaining guy on SmackDown, and
yeah.
You know, that show has its has the problems. Even when he was the focal point of it, you know, he felt this. I mean, he felt like it should have been a bigger deal just because he was carrying it, and he, you know, he didn't have everything, but he was the guy to watch. I mean, he still is in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and you're right though. He beat himself up a lot.
Right.
He shouldered a lot of the pressure. He didn't need to. I know. I was telling Doc he and I had had that conversation in Cincinnati when he had the title, and I told him, I said, you know, back, you know, I said, you're putting a lot of pressure on yourself. And, oh yeah, you know, and but I said, there's no need for that. I said, you know, and I said to Doc earlier, I said, as much as this is a business of individuals, in many ways it's a team sport too, and so you can't lay all the, you know, the blame at any.
Timing is everything.
Yes.
I mean, you know, timing is everything, and a lot of big stars. I mean, you look at the very top stars. The timing was just perfect, and they came in and filled it and worked really hard to do that. And you know, with him, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I thought his work was really good, and they just didn't have the, you know, for whatever reasons, they didn't have the support for him at that point, talent wise and creative wise.
Exactly.
You know, no, and yeah, he really did feel it. I mean, I think that's why he kind of got away from that part and wanted to work with, you know, wanted to work with Ray and, you know, really do a long-term storyline because he was working with somebody he enjoyed working with and thought would get the best out of him. And, that was part of it, too.
Yeah, I had made the comment when during that whole story, I was like you, too. There were certain things in a particular storyline that didn't gel for me either, but he made them work. And I would find myself sitting there watching and thinking, you know, I'm not buying the storyline, but he's making me buy into it anyway.
Yeah, and that's real talent. I mean,
yes.
That's real ability. And you know, of course, and then you had he and Ray were just they really had something. So what a great baby face. So.
Yeah, the writers owe a lot to Eddie for pulling off some of their stupider stories.
You know, I will say in this case, and as much respect and love as I have for the WWE creative team a lot of the time, I think that story was pretty much him and it was Ray and Eddie.
Yeah.
I mean, it had more depth to, even with some things that I didn't like putting that kid in that situation. I didn't think that, we talked about it. I thought that it would that cause some damage that wasn't really worth doing, but
right.
He had a hard time with reality and fantasy at that age. But and it, from what I understand, he did. But I mean, the depth of that, even with where the police and why they all are under arrest or thrown into court somewhere,
mm-hmm.
The depth of that was very different than most of the storylines you get from WWE these days. So I mean, it's going to be don't know. This is going to be a real interesting thing. I think they'll do the right thing and do okay for a couple of weeks, but after a few weeks, we'll see what the reaction is to all this.
Yeah. I think he was actually his involvement, this whole Butch and Sundance thing that he was doing with Batista was tending to keep Dave in the mix more than the writers were.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the things that happened was he was supposed to turn and they planned it all out, and when they went to New Mercy and he started to turn, the fans were picking Eddie over Batista, and so I think that's what turned it into the Butch and Sundance.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It was just, I mean, I had problems with he's this awful guy, and he's this awful guy one week, and the next week it's just like, oh, okay, he's a nice guy, and all this. But I mean, that's just a creative thing. I mean,
yeah.
Part of it was he's such, you really had to have a good baby face because he was so devious in such an entertaining way that he was going to be the baby face, even when he was being terrible. So.
Yeah.
Acting like a jerk. So.
He was the kind of guy that, the fans finally switched Austin.
Right.
And even no matter how hard he would have tried, they would have brought him back anyway.
Right. No, that's all, yeah. He and I do think there was. I mean, I do think if ever there was a guy to really build a new audience for WWE with the Hispanic audience, it was Eddie. I mean,
yes.
I think they just missed. I mean, I think they. They missed some real opportunity there, and it was happening. So, and there were times when SmackDown wasn't getting anything, but those fans, and they were so strong in the Southwest because of that, because of him.
Yeah. There were times I've watched that 2 hours, and the only thing that I left remembering was whatever segment he happened to be in.
Yeah.
Or if it was worth remembering, I probably should say.
Right. So I mean, it's just, there was, And I think too, that group of great wrestlers and that real camaraderie that they all have. So I think it's the first. Probably the first one for them. But I mean, I know I swing on this and try to say something. But I mean, I hope that this leads to some changes that make some people's lives better.
Yeah.
Make some of the wrestlers' lives better. And I think there are things that can be done. So. We'll see.
Yeah, it seems to me like they're on the verge of something like that now with this situation and this tragedy.
I hope so. I don't know. I mean, I thought that, but I've always thought that there'll be a day, that this may be the one, or it may not be, but when the day comes, it'll just come that things that some things are taken seriously and not just the fatalistic. This is the wrestling business. It's not the it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, the situation reminds me a lot of Chris Candido too, who had gotten over his demons and just kind of suddenly passed away too.
Well, I mean, there's several, there's several that fit this pattern, so
mm-hmm.
I'm afraid. So.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, you're right.
Well, you're listening to Bruce Mitchell here on Wrestling Weekly. We are going to take a break. Check out Bruce's stuff over at pwtorch.com.
And Bruce, you're always, when you're in your columns, you, at the end, you always say, Bruce recommends reading this or that. Have you read Heath, what's it, McCoy, is it, that wrote the was it Pain and Passion?
I have read that book. I was actually planning to write about it when the Bret Hart DVD came out, just because I thought it would make a real good, make a real good kind of addendum to that book. But
didn't you think it was a great book?
I highly recommend that book.
Me too. I just finished it today.
Yeah, I just thought, it's talk about one of the more interesting and deep and funny and every other thing territorial books you'll ever read. I mean, I thought it had everything. That guy did a tremendous job.
Yeah, he covered everybody's side of the story. It wasn't like he was leaning toward one way or the other either.
No.
I thought some of his revelations about Martha Hart were very strong and to the point, too.
Yeah, I did, too, and I learned some things about Martha Hart that I didn't understand. I've always been sympathetic to her, but I could also see where some people were, were real upset. I mean, he did a real good job of a three-dimensional thing of how it, I mean, it really was a great book. I have to say, too, since I guess he's going to be coming on in a minute, I really enjoyed J.J. Dillon's book and learned some things from that book, too.
Yeah.
Particularly about what it's like to be in that, in the jackpot working for Vince McMahon, to be the bad cop. That,
right.
It was an entertaining book, too. Not an entertaining book, a real educational book, too.
Yes, you're absolutely. Yeah, I just finished that earlier in the weekend, so you're right. Yeah, it's they're both good reads. Anybody that is interested in wrestling business, probably two of the best books I've seen written.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
That makes a good segue because J.J. Dillon is coming up next here on Wrestling Weekly.
Well, I try to be a segue, so I'm kind of in the Tony Randall spot. the guy that Reed just calls in when no one else will show up or whatever.
Well, Bruce, I know you got to study for the you're gonna move up in the world a little bit.
Yeah, maybe I'll make it a fourth grade someday.
Well, we probably are going to be doing a couple camps a year in Spindale. So I'm coming.
I honestly am coming. I want to see that. I mean, it's a good.
I've told Jamesy to stay away. That you were coming as my guest
I'm sure that would mean a lot to him. I'm sure that would impress him to all hell. All right, guys. Take care.
Bruce, bye. Thank you so much, and you too. Take care.
We'll see you again in a few weeks, Bruce.
All
thanks.
Right. Bye.
That's Bruce Mitchell from PW Torch here on Wrestling Weekly. Les, you got some stuff coming up.
Yeah. Actually, what I've just mentioned to Bruce at the end of this week, that's one, one that we came down early to visit with family here in North Carolina. But the 18th and 19th, this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we're in Spindale, North Carolina, at the Spindale House. We're doing a three-day training camp, plus there's two legend shows on Friday and Saturday night, just 50 miles apart, back-to-back. If you're a fan, if you're an independent wrestler, it'd be a great weekend for you. We're running a three-day camp, and Friday it'll be the old EPW crew will be in attendance. Harley will be there, Dr. Tom, myself. And Tully Blanchard is joining us, and I think JJ is going to come as well. I was talking to Matt Holder, the promoter, earlier today, and I think JJ is going to put in an appearance as well. We're talking to him about that. But then Friday night, Matt's New Generation Wrestling is running a real Legends Loaded show at the Spindale House where we're running the camp. Luger and Steiner against the Midnight Express, Tony Atlas against Ivan Koloff in a chain match, Jimmy Valiant is the referee, JJ will be in the house, Harley, I'm not sure who else will be on, I don't have the card in front of me. Then the next day, I'm staying to run the camp, and I think possibly JJ will be hanging with me and Tracy Smothers. Harley and Tom are headed down to Spartanburg, where they're running the Starcade tribute. which is through Carolina Championship Wrestling, Tony Hunter's group.
Oh, that's going to be a good one.
Yeah, a whole bunch of Dusty's in the house for that. It'll be a lot of the same people that are on the show Friday, but with the addition of Dusty and Terry Funk. And I think Ivory is on that show, several of the girls. Anyway, a great weekend for, like I say, and if you're interested still, there's time to sign up for the camp. We're running 3 days. You can go to ngwmatt@yahoo.com. That's Matt Holder's email to sign up, get more information on everything. We always have a great turnout and a great time. And gosh, if, with all the guys involved in this training camp, there's over 150 years of high-level professional wrestling experience. So if you can't learn something there, then I guess you just can't learn. All plus the two legend shows, which are always big draws. I'll say we'll do 700, 800, and maybe or more in Spindale on Friday night, and they will probably do 1,200 or better in Spartanburg the following night. So as far as this part of the country, independent wrestling is very alive and flourishing. And then Dr. Tom and I are doing a three-day camp December 1, 2, and 3 in West Liberty, Kentucky at the Montgomery County Community Center. It's a three-day camp, Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
The Bluegrass State.
Yeah, Retro Wrestling Alliance is the sponsor, Joey Bravo. And you can sign up for that or get more information by emailing admin. Yes, at rwaonline.biz. I have to stop and think about these things.
that's no problem.
Yeah, but anyway, yeah, we're so great time. And then I just talked to the CWE promoter a week or so ago, and we're doing another big show in Tulsa in February, and I think we'll be doing a camp out there as well. So
excellent.
Yeah.
So you got some good stuff coming up.
Yes, sir.
We're going to take a break, guys, and when we come back, we've got our featured guest, J.J. Dillon, is going to be on the show. It's Doc Young and Les Thatcher here on Wrestling Weekly. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back after this. Doc Young, Les Thatcher here back with you at Wrestling Weekly. On the line right now is our featured guest. Want to welcome him on this sad occasion, but it's J.J. Dillon's on the line with us. Thanks, J.J., for being on the show.
Hey, Doc, and I want to say hi to you and Les both.
Yeah, and, we were talking just before we came back on the air, and, of course, this whole show didn't set out to be about Eddie Guerrero, but it basically, there's a lot of things, and let's start there. I want to talk about your book because I just finished reading it, and knowing you as well as I do, it was an emotional roller coaster ride for me in several chapters. But you were just telling us before we went on the air that you've known Eddie since he was 7 years old.
Yeah, I started full time, as you know, with you, Les, in the Carolinas in 71, and I was there till 73. Well, let's see, yeah, 73, and then in 74. I went to Amarillo, and of course, one of the regular towns in Amarillo was El Paso, that was promoted by Gory Guerrero, who was a legendary wrestler in his own right. Of course, he's retired at that point, and he was just promoting. But all the Guerrero boys, Chavo Sr., and Eddie, and Mondo, and Hector, were maybe not during the school days so much, but certainly during the summertime. You would see them running around, and so I watched them all grow up and mature, and all of them have been involved at one time or another in the wrestling business, and I would think Chavo certainly had a degree of success in a different era, but Hector, he did great, and he's had his problems along the way. I worked with him in Atlanta, of course, and so I'm familiar with some of the trials and tribulations that he's been through. But you never prepare yourself for something like this, because 38 years old is too young to die.
Yeah, and I think of the whole family, and no disrespect to anybody else, but I think Eddie was the crown jewel in terms of talent.
Yeah, Eddie was far in a way the one that, and of course he was the right place at the right time. He going to the WWF / WWE and gave him the opportunity to take the talent that God gave him and to run with it. And I think what he's done speaks for itself, what he's accomplished.
Well, when he had that horrific car wreck, he was with you in WCW.
Yes.
And that
could have been potentially career-ending in and of itself.
Life-ending, too.
Life-ending, absolutely, because he was touch-and-go for a while.
Yeah. And that's what we've said. Everybody, you know, Doc and I and Bruce Mitchell was on earlier, was the guy who has overcome so much, you know, and it seems like, I mean, the last few years he and the family are good. He's at the top of his game. He's certainly, you know, every storyline he's been involved in, he's done a four-star job at it. And then just to go out like this is just such a sad state of affairs.
Yeah, my heart goes out to the entire Guerrero family.
Yes.
Their words just don't do justice to, I'm sure, what we're all feeling.
No, not at all. And we got to stop thinking about what his wife and his daughters have. I mean, after the separation and they're just, I mean, now they've been back together for a few years, but that's such a short blip in time considering that they're never going to be able to see him again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's terribly, terribly sad. I have read one of the best books about wrestling that I've ever read, and now I know, we'll have to tell Doc, because I don't think he's read the book. Wrestlers are like seagulls from McMahon to McMahon, that I know where the title came from, Doc, and you don't.
Well,
unless,
yes, that's
sworn
true.
To secrecy now.
Well, I didn't get my free copy yet. I think it got lost in the mail.
Well, I'll tell you what, anybody out there that wants to get into writing books, to make money, I'll tell you. You better be like me and have it be a labor of love, because putting aside the hours and all that, just the dollars, real dollars involved with. If you want to do it right, and I think we did it right, we did a hardbound book, and if you do it, with the printing costs and the binding and the shipping, and it costs a lot of money to write a book, and to be honest with you, I have yet to see any profit from it. And Scott Teal, my co-author, fronted all of the out-of-pocket costs. And, again, we don't even want to get into 8 months of work on his part and my part, but it was all worth it to have somebody like Les Thatcher, that's been a friend of mine, that goes back to the early 70s, to say that he read it and enjoy it. And I've been very gratified that I've heard similar comments echoed by other people. And Les, you probably would find this interesting. Paul Bearer, who is also Percy Pringle, who's William Moody, who I've known for a long time, and really worked with him at the WWF when I was there in a management position, got my book, read it, and started reading it. He was going to take it home with him, and between rides on the airplane and what have you, he couldn't put it down, he said, till he finished reading it. And then there's a nice comments from him posted on my website. But he basically said that all those years that he knew me from a talent management perspective, and really didn't know me as a person the same as I didn't know him. And it was only after reading the book that he found out, and Jim Cornette has said the same thing, that they're tremendous similarities to where we came from in terms of all being young kids that fell in love with the business, that chased our dream and had many similarities. And what he was saying to me is, it's like I finally feel that I now know you after all these years, and I really didn't. And had a renewed respect for me, and that's very, very gratifying.
You mentioned Cornette, but I was thinking, too, especially toward the end of the book, you know, where you'd mentioned that you were helping your mom. And, through all this, every place you've traveled and all you've done, and you finally end up back home helping your mom. And I thought, well, you know, I did the same thing until my mother passed away. Jim Cornette has done the same thing. And Bob Harmon, who you met Bob?
I certainly remember Bob, absolutely.
Sure, okay, and that's exactly, his mother is 92 years old now.
Yeah, my mother's going to be 91 the week after Christmas. So, I think, Les, that this, goes beyond the bounds of the wrestling business. I think, my parents supported me in chasing my dream. And I never forgot that. And I feel that that made me a better person, the way I was brought up, and having that support through the ups and downs, as we both know, there's lots of them before you have any degree of success in this business, just to survive. And I think in the later years, the time comes when you need to give back, and I'm not doing anything special. I'm just doing the right thing, and a lot of other people do it too.
Yeah, I agree. And my mom and dad were the same way. They were very supportive. Well, you met my mom and dad, and they were very supportive of me chasing the dream. And I think that's the thing that I don't. And until you've chased a dream, until you've tasted or touched it or whatever you want to call it, you can read it, but you can't understand it completely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Until you've been there and done that. I don't really believe. I think that's. I think the thing that was most interesting to me, kind of like Percy, was although I knew I had heard the stories about that horrible Jim Dillon, that SOP, who fired guys and cut payoffs and everything, and I'm thinking, wait a minute here, that's not the guy I used to run around with. That's and the point is, he's just the messenger, as you say in the book, and the hell of it was, you were put in that position basically in both companies. So it's sort of from the frying pan to the fire, as it were, from WWE or WWF at the time to WCW.
Mm-hmm. And I think part of it has to do with just my makeup personally, my personality. I'm an easygoing person. I always thought I was level-headed, and I was also a very caring person. And I never, ever lost sight of the fact that I was a talent, and many of the things, in fact, virtually everything, every situation that I came across that I had to deal with, I was familiar with from the other side as a talent, and I always was, like, aware of the sensitivities from the talent side, and I always tried to approach, you know, and like you say, in many cases, I was the messenger. And
yeah.
Even now, Percy, when I saw him a week or so ago, he said, you know, I used to see you coming, and he said, I wouldn't make eye contact. I would look the other way and hope you wouldn't stop, because it was like every time he saw me or heard my voice, it was always bad news. You were in trouble for something you shouldn't have done, or you were being asked to give up a day off to go do a promotional thing that you weren't going to get paid for. It was all those negative things, but you know, I always try to do it with sensitivity, and I always try to do it with fairness, too. But a lot of guys in the business,
you know,
never understood my role, never figured that out.
The thing, I think one of the things you just said, one of the key things to me, it was when I was involved with some offices, I was involved with the Charlotte office for a while, and then the Knoxville office, and Atlanta during the war years with the Gunkel NWA thing. But when I was an agent for Atlanta at WCW, when they were doing the tours in 82 and 83, someone down there had said to me, well, you know, you're not one of the boys anymore. And this person had never been one of the boys. And I said, well, you know, until you've made a 600-mile round trip for $20, you wouldn't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And if you forget that, then you've wasted your time anyway.
Right. And I think trying to draw that line and forget all of that, you know, I can't speak for you, but I know I couldn't have done the job any other way than the way I did it.
No. Mm-hmm. You're right. Well, and you know, and then of course part of the WCW thing that I'm familiar with, because Doc, I don't know if Doc knows it, but anyway, at one point, I was about to sign with WWF as a developmental trainer, and Gary Juster called me and said, well, somebody's reading our mail. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, JJ and I were just talking, and Terry Taylor were just talking about you the other day. Have you signed yet? And I said, no. Well, don't until we get to talk to you. So, but anyway, long story short, they flew me down there, and we made a deal, which was a very good one. And then it took us, like it seemed like forever, to actually consummate it. Mm-hmm. And then once we got set up, I sat there and I called JJ and I said, well, okay, I want to do something.
Yeah, I'm ready to go.
Yeah, and then I...
Red horse in the starting gate waiting for that bell to ring.
Yeah, and then I called Terry Taylor and I said, well, damn it, I'm ready to do something. And
I think in my book, I touch on the fact that the real root of the problem with WCW was that you had non-wrestling people that actually controlled and ran the business, and that was, I mean, I cite numerous examples in there, and you're talking about something else, but it's just one more example of all the things that went wrong that shouldn't have gone wrong. But again, non-wrestling people always looked at the wrestling business as being something that to them was very simple.
Yeah.
And though the concept is simple, and when it's running smoothly, it does seem to be simple, it's also very complex, and it takes people like you, like me, that have spent our whole life doing it to really understand everything and to be able to put everything in perspective.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Well, you know, and the thing, too, I know once I got involved, and I would say to people back in Cincinnati, you know, I don't quite understand this. There's JJ's down there, Terry, Joe Hamilton, all these people who I've worked with in the past who I know have fertile minds for this business, and they're all sitting basically sucking their thumbs.
Yep.
And people who I've never heard of, who have never taken a bump in their life, are running the show, and it just didn't make any sense.
Absolutely.
The frustration level was like difficult to put into words, and it's sad because I never knew Ted Turner personally. I met him a few times, knew him to say hello to. Going back into the 70s when we used when I was actually wrestling in the studio in Atlanta, and he would pop in on a Saturday morning. But he did so much for wrestling, going back to the programming at the beginning of the inception of the Superstation, and he always treated wrestling with respect and kept it on the air because it was good for him, like the Braves were. And to have a time slot on a Saturday, 6 o'clock, for 25 years or more, and to allow that to slip through your fingers, it just, you have to have been in the wrestling business to understand the value of that consistent time slot. And I mm-hmm. still to this day have people who will tell me that sometimes on Saturday they still find themselves planning their day to be home at 6 o'clock, and they're like, oh, that's right, wrestling's not on anymore.
Yeah.
But people,
you know,
it regulated people's lives.
Yeah. The whole thing, you know, your analogy and you're telling about that Bischoff and the way he was, his personality. My only contact, and this was so amazing, I had brought two of my, and you may remember this, I had brought two of my kids to Knoxville for dark matches. And I don't even remember what year this was. But anyway, during the course of the evening, I was standing talking to Mike Tenay, and all of a sudden I sensed someone, like, virtually putting their chin on my shoulder. And I turned to my, it was on my right, and as I turned my head to my right, I'm nose to nose with Eric Bischoff, who I've never been introduced to, never met in my life. And he says to Mike, he says, hey, that project, or whatever it was, that project you're working on, I was like, yeah, that's good, and okay, and just looked at me and turned around and walked off.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking, wait a minute, this is your company.
On the personality meter, he was in the negative.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, common courtesy, you know, introduce himself if you were having a conversation with Mike Tenay. Obviously, you know, you had to be somebody familiar with the business, and as a courtesy.
And I was backstage, so obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very sad and very frustrating because I think we now see what's happened to the business without a second strong player, and you know TNA is trying to do it, and hopefully they make it because the business needs. And I'm not talking about a Monday Night War situation again, where two of them trying to buy for the same offense. I'm just talking about a promotion with a different style. That's because Vince McMahon's product seems to go up a few notches with competition.
Yeah.
I was just going to cut in and say you're listening to J.J. Dillon here on Wrestling Weekly. And I do have good news, Les, that we did get the chat room up.
Good.
Good. So
before we go to there, one of the things first, though, and this hasn't been a lighthearted night, but I'm going to I'm going to say that one of the things that really ticked me off when I saw JJ's book and I got heat with me was when I saw him standing there with his arm around Duke Snyder. Now, I am a religious Brooklyn Dodger. Roy Campanella was my idol. I was a catcher. And I thought, well, you son of a... Well, you really got heat with me because I would have loved to have done that with
you. Yeah, it was... You know, I look back and wrestlers are like seagulls. Is some have called a history wrestling and modern wrestling, and maybe it is because I came in to the business interest level in the mid 50s. Right, you know, wrestling was already on television, and you know, Argentina Rock and some of the stars of that era were just not too far after, you know, Baron Leone and Gorgeous George and some of the real early ones, but I saw all the changes and transitions in wrestling right up through, you know, what Vince McMahon did with WrestleMania and the demise of all the smaller territories, and then WCW being the second player until they went out of business. So my whole career is almost interwoven through the history of modern wrestling. So it is a lesson and a lot of behind-the-scenes information, because it's a perspective from the inside, but at the same time it's also, I think, a great human interest story of a kid from Trent, New Jersey that was 14 years old, that's probably like a lot of other kids that turn on wrestling for the first time and their eyes pop open, and I just said this is what I wanted to do and chase my dream, and was able to get over all the hurdles and obstacles and disappointments, and I'm very thankful that you know, that I lived my dream, and as I look back, I had a wonderful career, and I'm a very, very fortunate individual, and I'm glad that Scott Teal talked me into taking the time to put it into words so that it's there for my children and anyone else that chooses to read it.
Yeah, you know, as much as an eye for detail as you have, and I told Scott Teal, I don't know if he mentioned it to you, I talked to him, I don't know how long ago it was, but I said, okay, I got to shoot holes in a couple of these Mr. Details. The night that Luther died, I was probably the last guy in the babyface dressing room to speak to him while he was alive. Mm. I was leaving the ring as he was going in, and we slapped hands, and I said, go get him, Buffy. And as you know, he called everybody Buffy, because that came from Stu. And in fact, the night that you worked for him, I've told that story several times, in defending you, son of a gun. When you were getting that, I son of a bitch, he fired me, you know, this or that. Mm. But that night that Luther got sick in Richmond, I was riding with you. We went to the house and picked him up and had dinner there.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's okay, though. I know after a few bumps on the head, you got...
Well, you know, right up at the front of the book, what's important is there's not that many people in almost 40 years in the business that I made a point of mentioning by name to say thank you with. But if you look through that list, you will find the name of Les Thatcher.
I know, and I appreciate
cool.
it. And before we get too crazy here, I want to say that I love you like a brother, and I really do. I mean, you've always been a class guy, but we, for whatever reason, we're a lot different in a lot of ways. But we gelled from the beginning, and it's always been. And the other thing is, Matt Holder told me today that you. He said that JJ's interested in sticking around and help with some of the training. I said, you're damn right he is. You're more than welcome, my friend, anytime to step in and give your 2 cents worth, because it's very valid as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I appreciate that. And I just hope that anybody that's listening, if you have an opportunity in the spare moment, check out jjdillon.com, which is my website that's been up about 3 years, and the banner for the book is at the top. But beside that, there's a lot of great pictures and information in there, and then everything about the book. You can see the book, you can read the chapter titles and the synopsis and some of the early reviews, and as Les has already said, you know, I'm hearing comments like maybe one of the best wrestling books ever written, and I don't know that it's the best, but I'm confident that I've heard it from enough people that it's up there near the top somewhere, and I think it's not in a bookstore. You're going to have to work to find it. And so go to my website, which will take you to Crowbar Press, which is Scott Teal's website. And but I'll guarantee if you get it, it's worth seeking out and worthy of a read.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, you know, the one thing that I think that maybe a lot of wrestling fans will not understand, but yet I do, and I have had younger people question me about this, is that, well, like your relationship with Vince, you're not you're explaining or expressing what your opinion was or what you felt that, and I would pretty much say 99%. In fact, you've been closer to him than I ever have, but I would say you've hit the nail on the head. But a lot of people would say, well, why aren't you bitter? Why aren't you mad? Why? Well, you know, I think those of us who actually love this business realize that there are certain things that you have to deal with to do to follow your dream.
Yeah.
And there are roadblocks that you have to walk around or climb over, and you can drive yourself crazy if you let yourself get eaten up with that type of thing.
And another thing in life, I think that anything that means anything to you, that's of value to you, I think you have to end up putting in a lot more than you take out.
Yeah.
And in my case, I think I did put a lot in, but in this case it's reverse. I the wrestling business did so much for me. It gave me an opportunity to learn and to grow and to travel places in the world that I never would have been able to go to before. The people I've met, the places I've gone. The wrestling business gave me so much that they don't owe me anything, and so for me to be bitter at this stage of my career, it would be so unfair.
Yeah, well, you know, I've had people say to me, "Well, you've worked for Watts and worked with Watts and Ole, and you know, you don't hate those guys." Well, I said, "No, that was just their way of venting or expressing themselves, and it's just it's part of the business."
And another thing I express in the book, and I believe this firmly too, and I think Les, you would have to agree with me, I've always made judgments based on how people dealt personally with me, not based on what their reputation was or what they were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
If a guy treated me right, regardless of what somebody else said, how could I in good conscience say anything negative about that person if my personal experience was only a positive one? And
yeah.
So that's how I've always approach things too. And if you read Wrestlers Like Seagulls, you I think see pretty quickly that it is not a hatchet job. It's not intended to be a vendetta against anyone. As Les said, I do express my opinions strongly, but I think back them up with the logic of why I came to the conclusions that I came, and then you can either agree with me or disagree with me. But with everyone, and that includes Vince McMahon, includes Dusty Rhodes, people I've worked with a lot, I think I also look at whatever my opinion is about what may be their shortcomings and weaknesses, but I also talk about their strengths and their accomplishments. I think my approach is balanced, and if you're going to do that with the people that you work with, I think you have to be willing to look into the mirror and also be honest about your own shortcomings and your own weaknesses and strengths, and I think I tried to do that as well.
Yeah, I agree with you. I've had people ask me, well, you were never, you know, I had one version of the NWA World Tag Team Champion and the U.S. Tag Team Champions, but mm-hmm. I was never a world champion. I was a contender as a junior heavyweight, you know. But they said, well, I said no, because the longer I was in the business and the more attuned I became and the more I learned about it, I realized that whatever it was, no, that wasn't my lot.
No, I wasn't worthy of that either. And I don't, I'm not ashamed to say that.
No.
And that's what made it so difficult when the Vince Russos of the world and David Arquette, you know, having
yeah.
one professional match in his career and being handed the world title, you know, where no matter where had it gone to at that point, when you spent your whole life in the wrestling business and have respect for the title and what it means and for the people like both Funks and Jack Briscoe and Harley Race and Pat O'Connor and you just, you know, Buddy Rogers, you can get down the list. It just was a very bitter pill for me to swallow when the business got to the point that the title became a joke.
Right. The only thing that I was really seriously, and I say as I read it, I became incensed, was where Jarrett had convinced you to do the one-on-one in the ring with Russo.
Yeah.
And my only thought is, JJ, you should have hit this SOP.
Well, again, it was everything that I always did with the business was for the business.
Yeah.
And that's when I finally realized that for the first time in my entire career, I was in a situation on television with someone that did not have the same respect, not only for me, but for the business. And you cannot go into something and make yourself vulnerable, which is what you do. You lay your soul open because you're in with people who you take care of them, and you just assume that they're going to take care of you. It's like, you know, I draw the analogy of the high wire, the trapeze artist that goes off and does the flip and turns and expects there to be a catch there.
Right.
And if the person who's doing the catch and doesn't care about you and doesn't care about his job, then the whole thing doesn't work. And that's the situation I got caught in, and I did regret it. But, you know, I went in because Jerry Jarrett was an old friend. He had done right by me, and it helped me, and I wanted to try and help him. It just was a bad situation when I got into it, and I realized pretty quickly, which is why I was there only the two times and never went back.
While we're on the Jarrett thing, and then I'll turn to Doc and jump to the chat room.
Okay.
Just recently, Jerry ends up in Stanford. Have you heard this?
Yes, I only information I know is probably the same information that you're getting, which is what I read on the internet.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm thinking now. I was on his first crew. I helped break him in as a referee and as a wrestler. And yet, I'm thinking that wasn't the most brilliant move I've ever seen. I don't quite understand.
Yeah, but you know, again, the business. Where the landscape of the business is now, with Vince being, you know, the only major player, and hopefully, you know, TNA going to survive and emerge where they will be, you know, accepted and respected as a major promotion. And Jerry had a lot to do with that. And
right.
Jerry has a passion for the business. He's been an innovator, and I think I point this out in the book. I mean, he did things way back when where, you know, he was ostracized by some of the other promoters as being crazy and for doing outlandish things, but he was ahead of the curve, much like I always felt Terry Funk was. So, you know, what you saw might have been something done totally out of frustration without talking to Jerry personally. I don't know. I was surprised, as you were. I don't know what Jerry's motive was, but I get a sense that it might have been more out of frustration than anything.
Yeah. Have you read his book that was written about forming TNA and so forth?
No, I haven't.
I've just read some excerpts, but I haven't seen the total thing either. But obviously, what did come to the forefront in the excerpts that I'd read, that he wasn't too enamored with Jeff's posse, if you want to call it that, that he was putting together to start the company either.
No. Well, and again, it's very difficult because, you know, the old saying about blood's thicker than water. And there's no doubt in my mind the love that Jerry Jarrett has for everyone in his family, especially his sons. He's got another young son who I had a chance to work with after WCW closed down in the construction side of the business. And you know, they're all good stock because, you know what, an acorn never falls too far from the tree. You know, and Jeff Jarrett's certainly done well. He and I, if you read the book again, you know, I've been very disappointed that he was held in high esteem in his eyes, and yet I feel that I was someone that went to great lengths to help him and open some doors for him along the way, but he seemed to align himself with some other people that in hindsight now, as you look back, maybe wasn't such a good judgment. And this, again, could be part of Jerry Jarrett's frustration.
Well, you know, the part where he felt that you should have maybe tried to get him a better deal, you know, in WCW once he left Vince. Well, that's like when I came down there to sit down with you and Gary, I realized that part of the reason I was there was because of your input. But then I wasn't going to jeopardize. I mean, when asked, well, what do you think's a fair deal? I could have thrown out some stupid numbers, but then that would have also jeopardized our relationship personally. But it would also jeopardize your position because Gary or Bush at the time might have said, well, why did you bring this insane man down here? are you nuts? You know, I mean, just the fact that I was there because of the background that I had with some of you guys was enough that I respected that, and I felt, you know, Jeff should be the same way.
Yeah, I think that's a great analogy, Les. And, again, you were there because you deserved to be there, because you had the credentials, and you were putting together something that was of value to WCW. Then when you sit down and start talking specifics and putting a dollar value to something, that sometimes that's where opinions can differ. And I always felt a responsibility, first and foremost, to the person who was signing my check.
Right.
You can't ever, you know, ever lose sight of that. But I never did anything that insulted anyone else. I always try to do the right thing, and like you say, there's always someone that says somebody could have done more. But if I had had that kind of a mindset, I wouldn't have survived as long as I
You're right.
as I could in the mm-hmm. business, because the guys that quote unquote did favors or made decisions that weren't good business decisions based on things like that didn't survive in the business, and usually the promotions that they were working with didn't survive either.
Yeah. One of the things you said toward the end of the book, and then I'll shut up and let Doc jump in here, is you said you respect people who stand the test of time, and I do too, and you're one of those people, so I
appreciate that.
Go ahead, Doc, before we get teary-eyed.
Okay. You guys hug, and I'll ask some questions here from the chat room. Agent Orange wants to know what your favorite era of wrestling was, 70s, 80s, 90s, or 2000s.
Wow. That's really a great question, and I don't know that I can accurately answer it. You know, you talk to different people, and everybody will have a different opinion, you know, based on their age, when they came into the business, that kind of thing. I mean,
right.
I have great memories back in the 50s of, you know, watching Argentina Rock and Carl Von Hessen and Chief Big Heart and Dr. Jerry Graham and Professor Roy Shires and that Skull Murphy and that cast of characters. I mean, that's what drew me, you know, to the business. And then once, you know, I got in the business, you know, watching people like Johnny Valentine and Wahoo McDaniels and, you know, here's someone in the business and I could be in the ring or on the apron with people like this and continue to be a believer because that was the style of work at that time. I guess I have to look at the mid-80s as it's probably what I'm best remembered for, depending on your age, because mm-hmm. that was the heyday of the Horsemen. And we had an incredible run, and it's one of those spontaneous things that took on a life of its own. But I go to some of these Legend reunion shows, and you know, I'm going to be in Spartanburg this weekend for a Salute to Starrcade, and a lot of Dusty's going to be there, and Magnum TA, and very gratifying for me to go back and to meet people, because as Les knows, you know, we were somewhat insulated from the fans back in the day, and now, you know, to be able to come back and on a set time to have the fans come and know that you're going to be there and be accessible to talk wrestling, bring their old souvenirs back to get autographed and take pictures and just trade personal stories is I'm enjoying the daylights out of this too, but I also find it mind-boggling that people 20 years after the fact, you know, remember the Horsemen as fondly as they do.
Mm-hmm. TNA fan says, why do you think wrestling has gotten away from dominant stables like the Horsemen? He said now it's just one star and some scrubs.
Well, I think the business itself has to get its house in order and get all its ducks in a row, and then once that happens, and a successful stable like the Horsemen is an extension of what's going on at the time. And when you look back at that era, and when you look at a card where you see Dusty Rhodes, Magnum TA, Nikita Koloff, the Road Warriors, you know, Barry Windham, you look at the Hands of Stone, Ronnie Garvin, you look up and down the card, Ricky Morton, Robert Gibson, the Rock and Roll Express, the Midnight Express with Jim Cornette, the depth of talent on the cards at that time was just unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have that kind of depth, then you can have a stable like the Horsemen emerge and be successful. But you can't start a promotion based on something like that and then have nothing to surround it.
And, of course, one of the reasons you don't see that type of talent, depth of talent today, is because back then there were the territories where there was a place for guys to develop.
Right, and anymore that doesn't exist unless you've been involved in training and the business needs for people like Les Thatcher to continue doing what you're doing, working with people like Harley Race to get out and to the teachers are gone. It's a lot of the young people come into the business don't even understand the basic concept of what they're doing or what they're trying to do. That's all been lost, and it has to be taught. And I think I had a phone call from someone who was very instrumental in me starting the business, and I'm talking about Bruno Sammartino. And I saw Bruno in Tampa earlier this year at one of the Legends deals for the first time in over 25 years, and I got there late because of bad weather, and hardly got to say hello, and that was it. And then I spent a little bit more time with him recently at another convention up in King of Prussia where Bruno was being honored. And he's just an incredible guy, and one of the things that he said is that the business maybe has to go back to what he called scorched earth, kind of like the farmer's field, where you just reach a point where everything has to be burned down so that there's nothing, and it looks like there's nothing living left, and it may have to sit there for a couple of years. Then all of a sudden, the sun shines and the rain comes, and you start seeing little hints of green growing from where there was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's where the wrestling business has to go, but I think it has to go full circle. It has to have the input of people like Les Thatcher who understand what this basic concept, it's simplistic, it's one-on-one, it's good versus evil, and then you start to develop the complexity of the people involved, but we got to get back to that if the business is going
to
survive.
And the younger guys have to learn to feed off the fans, not allow the fans to dictate what they do, but to feed off of them and listen and pay attention. And
that's a lost art.
Yes, absolutely.
A lost art.
Agent Orange, Crusher Cox says that you've managed several superstars in this business. What are some of your favorite people to work with?
Well, if you'll get a copy of Wrestlers Are Like Seagulls or go on my website and look at the front of the book, I'm standing there, an old picture of me with a smug, arrogant look on my face, but behind it is a mosaic, a wallpaper mosaic of some of the people who I have managed over the years, and it reads like the who's who of wrestling, not only the horsemen, but I started with Archie Goldie, the Mongolian Stomper, Abdullah the Butcher, Moondog Maine, Kendo Nagasaki, Angelo Mosca, Taro Tanaka, Jimmy Garvin, I mean, there's
Destroyer.
So many. The Destroyer, yes. It's very hard to take one. And, Archie will always be special to me because he was the first. He was the guy that called me up and said, I need a manager. And that I made the transition to that side of the business that I probably thought never would have occurred to me had I not gotten that phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I just went from place to place, from person to person, and I'm thankful for the time that I was in the business and at a time when there was such great talent and that I had the opportunity to rub talent with really some of the great names, Bruce Bernard, another one, some of the great names in wrestling.
Agent Orange asks, who do you name as the greatest world champ of all time?
Boy, that's a tough, tough question.
It sure is.
I guess what is your criteria for the greatest of all time? I'm a big fan of Ric Flair, and a lot of it has to do with, the time that I spent with him on the road and being so close to him and to see what he would do each and every night, regardless of the size of the crowd, that he would go out there and be Ric Flair because however many people were there that night, paid their admission price to get in to see him. It wasn't a question of his performance level, being commensurate to the size of the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I look at somebody like Bruno Sammartino, who he called me, he picked up a copy of my book, and all this, got a call out of the blue a week ago, and talked for an hour with Bruno, and specifics about the book, and this is one of the things. And I I look at what Bruno Sammartino was when I was growing up in the early 60s, and the list of sellouts that he had in Madison Square Garden. And this was a situation where he was coming back show after show after show after show. He never really got a – it wasn't like he went away for a while and somebody else carried the torch. It was Bruno, Bruno, Bruno for such a long time. And I wonder what would have happened if instead of Hulk Hogan, who was the first to be out there with Vince McMahon when he went national and got that kind of exposure and got a chance to really go all across the country and be showcased, who knows, you know, where Bruno Sammartino would have ended up. He's already an icon, but in terms of trying to be able to say who was the greatest champion, that's tough. Bruno will always be special to me. Ric Flair, because of what I saw him do. And yet, at the same time, I have to give credit to somebody like Hulk Hogan, who was there at the right place, the right time. And I saw the magic of what he had at a television taping when people would sit there for 4 hours watching one enhancement match after another that was very one-sided. And then when he would come out after 4 or 5 hours and had the ability to just erupt that crowd and electrify the audience. You know, that's something that very few guys in the business have, and it's, you know, we're not talking about ability, we're talking about, you know, drawing money and selling tickets.
That's the one thing about our business is in baseball, if you're judging the best hitters, then you just go to the record books or
right.
The best high percentage infielders or whatever. But in our business, there's a Flair who had charisma and a tremendous in-ring talent, and then there's Hogan who had charisma.
Yes.
And not necessarily, you know, and Jim and I'll both tell you that we've both seen guys who could barely slap their ass both hands, is the old expression, that drew a lot of money. Because
yeah, I mean, I always remember Tex McKenzie that they used to
yeah.
laugh that Tex would come in the ring, trip over his own feet, getting into the ring, fall flat in his face, and his hat would fall off. But the people, there was something that he had that endeared himself to the people that they looked beyond that, and he drew nothing but money. And yet there have been guys who were, mechanically speaking, great workers, and they just never, for whatever the reason, you know, got beyond a certain level to reach superstardom.
Sure. How many guys, we're talking about the Carolinas, Johnny Heidemann, a tremendous mechanic, right?
Yes.
But was never probably Doc. You ever heard of Johnny Heidemann?
No, I haven't.
You sure have not. But a pleasure to work with, a great gentleman and a tremendous talent. But he never had that look or that was in that right place at the right time or whatever. But Jim and I, a lot of guys that you've never heard of that we had great matches with that would never make a list of the greats, but yet they were probably as good a talent as some of the big names you've heard from that era.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely right.
JJ, how much has the business changed between managing the Horsemen for Crockett Promotions and managing them under WCW?
Well, everything has changed, and I think change is inevitable, and change, unfortunately, is not always for the better. Things, you know, things can't stay like they are. That just isn't how it is, and I think you have to be that those that have the ability to change with the changes, survive and continue to flourish.
Mm.
And the business has just changed so much. People will ask me, you know, do I miss the business? And I tell them, no, I don't miss the business. I miss what the business used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to survive and to have a chance to enjoy the glory years again, I think we have to go full circle, as I've said, and go back and get back to basics. The only problem with that is the cost to promote television today, the cost of television time, insurance, travel, everything else almost makes it prohibitive unless you have somebody like a Ted Turner that just has almost unlimited resources and a passion for this particular art form and says, you know, I'd like to see wrestling again, and then sticks by it and makes it happen.
Mm-hmm. Lawson says that you work closely with Vince McMahon and Jim Crockett. How would you compare the two?
Well, I think they're two different individuals. Both enjoyed a degree of success. I don't talk so much about Jim Crockett in Wrestlers Like Seagulls, but I I think one of the things that Dave Meltzer said was that probably my portrayal in words of Vince McMahon is probably closer to the mark than anything else that he's ever read. Mm-hmm. And again, I was a part of that inner circle for almost 8 years, so I'm writing from a different perspective, and I'm also someone that's on the outside now that's not waiting for the phone to ring for Vince McMahon to offer me a job. So I like to feel that I, again, it wasn't a hatchet job, but it was very, very honest, and sometimes people are reluctant to be even totally honest and hope that somebody's feelings aren't going to be hurt, and maybe I'll get that one more run.
Right.
Well, you know, I think the thing is that what a lot of people don't understand, Doc, is that you may not agree with everything, but we basically are like hired guns. And I'm like Jim. I may not have, when I worked for Crockett Promotions, I may not have agreed with everything we did. I may even voice that to a certain degree. But that company was family, and I was loyal to that company as long as I worked with them. Mm. And Jim had that same stance. But to me, I think one of the biggest things today, and I won't even limit this to WWE, without even working for any of these other companies, I can almost guarantee it goes on there as well, is they pay. If you're looking for a yes man, you can get those guys for, you know, $250 a week. They'll wash your car. Mm-hmm. If I'm paying a guy six figures, I want him to challenge me occasionally, because if he tells me every day of my life that I'm right, then I know he's wrong, because nobody is, you know, is right all the time.
And it takes a certain personality and a person with confidence. You know, that's one of the things I always admire about Pat Patterson. I feel that way about Jerry Briscoe. You know, Pat Patterson in particular learned how to communicate with Vince McMahon, and that's maybe the hardest part of that job. Like you say, you know, Vince always said that he wanted to hear the truth, but a lot of times deep inside, telling Vince the truth was very difficult, and
yeah.
He made it difficult for you. And some guys just couldn't do it. You know, sometimes that resistance, and they got families to feed, and they push it so far, and then when they get that strong resistance, they back up.
Yeah.
Well, JJ, I want to thank you for being on the show this week, especially in light of what's happened today. I appreciate you coming on the air.
Yeah, this was a tough one for me, too, because, like I said, I've known Eddie Guerrero going back to the time that he was just a young kid. It's a terrible loss, not only for wrestling, of course, but for his family, too, and I just, my heart goes out to him, and I'm glad that, you know, for the time that we had, and I hope that people will go to jjdillon.com and pick up a copy of my book, and maybe at some time in the future we can do this again and field more questions at a time when everybody's not with such a heavy heart.
Yes, and when Doc finally figures out why the title of the book is Wrestling Juice.
Right, Doc, that's the challenge. You find out and then give me a call.
Okay, I will.
Jim, I'll see you in about 5 days.
Absolutely, and the best to both of you, and Les, I'll see you this weekend.
All right, my friend, God bless.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye, JJ. Well, Les, we did it.
Yeah, and let me say that to those listening and those in the chat room, thank you so much for being with us. I'm not sure that we were entertaining this week, because I said to Doc when we came on, I said, if I choke up on you here, or if I tell you I'm going to step away for a moment or so, please bear with me. This has been very personal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like JJ said, my prayers, my thoughts go out to Eddie's wife and the children and the brothers and the family. And as I said at the beginning of this show, there's a big void in the wrestling business tonight, and the fans who appreciated quality professional wrestling have lost a great talent, and those of us who have called Eddie friends have lost a loved one.
Yes, we didn't have time to go ahead and promote TNA's pay-per-view Genesis, so that's going to be starting in just a couple minutes here, so enjoy that pay-per-view.
With a couple new faces, we're told, so
yes.
It should be interesting.
Yes, it's going to be
interesting. You know who we have next week?
Yes, next week DDP is going to make his appearance. And we've got the Sandman.
All right.
So it's going to be a good show next week, so join us 6 to 8 Eastern next Sunday. I want to thank WrestleTalk Radio for their help tonight. Of course, don't forget to check out ObsessedWithWrestling.com. It's good stuff. Also, when you're talking about good stuff, it's lesthatcher.com. Keep up on what Les is doing. And epwt.com.
Yes.
It's Elite Pro Wrestling Training Seminars.
And if you're in the Spindale, Spartanburg, North Carolina area this weekend, we're running a three-day camp. Stop by and say hello.
All right. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks for joining us. And it's been a tough show for me, so I can only imagine, Les, how it's been for you.
Well, we got through it, and I just wish it had been a much happier an occasion.
Absolutely. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to Wrestling Weekly. Please join us again next Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern right here on WrestlingWeekly.com.